Well, thank you very much. Good morning to everyone. It is indeed a pleasure to be here with you all to launch this book, Connecting to Global Markets. You may or may not believe it, but I lost some sleep last night because I was leafing through it, and I found it amazingly interesting. And I was going through the different countries and different experiences that the chairs found, and kept me late longer than I expected. But it was a good investment. Let me start then by congratulating the WTO chairs who contributed to the book, of course. And in my view, and from what I saw, it represented a great deal of hard intellectual work. And I hope that it will be read far and wide. I certainly will dedicate more time to it, I'm sure of that. Now, the aim of the WTO chair program is to build academic capacity in developing countries in order to improve policymaking on trade, in particular where the WTO is related. Now, for the last 4 years, it has supported curriculum development, research and outreach activities by universities and research institutions. And so it strikes me that the book is a very fitting conclusion to this first phase of the program, because it is based on an important premise, which is that in a more globalized economy, where developing countries have emerged or re-emerged as major trading powers, and where new ways of organizing production have become a lot more widespread than before, it is the countries that can connect to this new trading system that will more quickly and more effectively reach growth and development. And the authors, the WTO chairs, were able to clearly identify some of the major challenges that these countries face in trying to achieve this connection. I think in the public at large, if you look at papers, newspapers, news, academic work, everybody recognizes that the means of production have changed and the way that the economies interact have changed significantly. What we have not figured out yet, or at least there is no common view yet, is to how do countries benefit from these opportunities? How do we tap into this potential, which is larger markets and easier ways of fitting into these production systems? That is, I think, the major challenge, and the diversity that the developing countries have is illustrated in the book and in what you have before you. You would see, for example, if you look at the book, which is really interesting, is that there are a variety of challenges which are identified for different developing countries. So there is, for example, the diversification of exports. Many countries are trying to achieve that by integrating better in these global value production chains. Some are looking rather at upgrading their participation in the value chain. So they are in the value chains, but they want to introduce their products at a higher level of sophistication with more value added in the production of those countries. So that's another objective. Another one is how do you make sure that the SMEs benefit? It's not only about the big players, the ones that already have easy connections and know how to navigate the waters of international globalized trade, but how do the SMEs benefit as well and participate productively in those value chains? And finally, and this is not an exhaustive list, by the way, there is the issue of non-tariff barriers. So a lot of countries figure out that not only are their exports concentrated on a few products, but even those products are subject to non-tariff barriers, and I think SPS measures are usually mentioned in that context. So the book is a clear testament to developing countries and their trade interests and to the diversity of developing countries and their trade interests and capabilities. Because the developing country, when you label a country a developing country, that only tells you part of the story. It doesn't tell you the full story. It is precisely this diversity that puts into check the idea that the north-south divide on trade is a uniform or a unequivocal element of reality. The reality, in fact, is much more complex, and we need to look a lot closer if we want to understand the real picture. Now, in other areas, however, in contrast to this, some old ideas are found to be valid. For example, the positive relationship between international economic rules and economic development. So a number of the chair's country studies show that the rules-based system accelerates the adoption of good trade policies. So that is an empirical, I think, understanding that we had in the past, and it's proving to be accurate. The book, of course, also shows the importance of initiatives like, for example, the Aid for Trade initiative in seizing the benefits that are offered by these globalized opportunities. But perhaps the clearest message here is just how much academics can contribute to policymaking in developing countries. And academics are in a position to approach issues in a breadth, with a breadth of depth and analysis, which is simply impossible for many others, such as politicians, for example. Academics have space to consider the changes in the global economy so they can identify not only today's challenges and opportunities, but also look at tomorrow, look at the future, in a longer perspective, something that politicians not always can. The elections are not always so far away. And they are not bound by the silos, for example, of specific responsibilities which can exist in government. They can take a broader view, a more holistic view of the issues, and like economic welfare, for example. And this freedom from day-to-day policy making means that they are better prepared, or better placed than many to take the long view, like I said, and an essential virtue for those dealing with economic development, because, as you well know, this economic development is something that is not achieved overnight. So they can assist policymakers by employing or creating more precise measures, in particular to measure the impacts of their policies and programs, and that's extremely critical. To paraphrase Lord Kelvin, which was a big contributor to science, in his words, if you cannot measure it, you cannot improve it. So by demonstrating the contribution that the academic community can make to policymaking, the book makes a very powerful case for the WTO Chairs Program itself. It shows the value of building this academic capacity in developing countries where most often it's in short supply. We should also thank the current WTO chairs and the members of the advisory board for the success of the program since its launch in 2010. I'm delighted that we will be renewing the program for another 4 years, and we look forward to supporting another generation of WTO chairs, as was mentioned just a moment ago, and I have no doubt that we will benefit again from their research and insight as we are benefiting today. I think this work is particularly welcome and particularly relevant at this juncture of the WTO's life. As you know, in December, members were able to conclude a multilateral agreement for the first time since the organization was created in 1995. And the Bali package represents an important boost, I think, to trade and development around the world. At last, we're doing what we should be doing, which is negotiating serious issues and making new rules which deliver benefits for all members. So it is vital also that all members can play their full role in this debate. Bali was historic, of course, for a number of reasons, but crucially, it put in check the notion that trade negotiations will inevitably end in a north-south divide. I'm pleased that this reality is also reflected in the book. So Bali changed the ballgame, that's for sure. Developing countries fought for the results and for a successful outcome as much as anybody else. The few voices that actually expressed reservations about the general balance of the agreement did not find any significant echo in the developing world. But of course, the work is not done. With the success in Bali, we have earned the right to work harder and to tackle even bigger issues. Now we have two very significant tasks. Of course, the first one is to implement the decisions that we achieved in Bali. The credibility of the organization and of what we will do in the future will depend a lot on how successful we are in implementing the outcomes of what we agreed on. But also a second part of the mandate is to figure out, before the end of this year, how we're going to move forward with the multilateral negotiating agenda, therefore the DDA itself. Now, what we do now, like I said, will define the future of the WTO, so it is essential that all members have the capacity to participate and support this debate. As with the negotiations that led up to Bali, I will do everything I can to ensure the process is transparent and inclusive. The better engagement and integration of developing countries and least developed countries into the multilateral trading system is absolutely vital for their growth and development. But equally, I think, it is the defining test on whether or not the system works. If it doesn't work for them, it doesn't work at all. And I see initiatives such as the Chairs Program as essential steps towards ensuring that we pass that test. So I have spoken a lot more than I should, really. I do congratulate you on the excellent work that was done. That gives us assurances that our investment here was fruitful for all members, and we hope that the decision that we are taking to extend the program, not only in terms of time but also in more number of chairs, is something that will turn into dividends for the organization. And for the countries that are participating and those that are not participating, but that will benefit from the insights that they can read and find in books like this one. So thank you very much. Congratulations again. I'm sure we will come back to you in the second phase. So thank you. Thank you very much.